Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.15, the First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition. On December 14, 1899, Damad Mahmud Pasha, the brother-in-law of Sultan Abdulhamid, fled the Ottoman Empire with his two sons, Prince Sabahaddin and Prince Lutfullah. And when this nobleman from the Sultan's inner circle and his two sons reached Europe, they promptly declared themselves as new members of the Ottoman opposition. Okay, so I want to take a brief second here and just bask in the 19th century for a little bit longer. It is December 1899, and yes, we are on our 32nd episode of this podcast called 20th Century Revolutions. And while we probably could spend, I don't know, the entirety of this episode on the last 2 weeks of 1899, we are not going to do that. So that means I've got big news, boys and girls. Today, we are going to finally make it to the actual real-life 20th century. So yeah, it's a big day. But before we do, I just wanted to take a moment of silence to bask in the 19th century for just a bit longer. All right, so the flight of Damad Mahmud Pasha would mark a major turning point in the history of the Young Turk movement. Over the previous year, the movement had been floundering somewhat, never quite being able to regain the momentum it had mustered leading up to the failed 1896 coup. Momentum that had been lost with Abdulhamid's victory over the Greeks in 1897, and with the mass defection of Young Turks surrounding Minzani Murad Bey in early 1898. These two events had been incredibly deflating for the Young Turks who remained in exile. And following the defection of Minzani Murad, the torch of the opposition had been carried on, as always, by Ahmed Reza and his Paris circle at Mejferet, as well as by Ishak Shakuti and the Geneva branch now publishing the journal Osmanli. And then there was also the Cairo branch we talked about last week, which had been taken over by members of the ulama and who had recently pushed the Young Turks to adopt the rhetoric of a religious struggle in their effort to gain the support of ulama reformers and other pious Muslims. And then one more wing of the CUP, who we have not been talking much about because they have just kind of been doing their own thing, is the group surrounding CUP founder Ibrahim Timo, who had built up a branch over in Romania. So that is all to say that throughout 1898 and 1899, the Young Turks in Paris, Geneva, Cairo, and in Romania continued to publish in their respective journals. However, the movement lacked coherence, and their relevance in the empire had declined due to the relative optimism witnessed after Abdulhamid's victory over the Greeks. But when word began to go round that the Sultan's own brother-in-law and two of the Sultan's nephews had now joined the opposition, well, this news would breathe new life into the Young Turks. And in later years, many Young Turks would claim that the flight of Damad Mahmud Pasha had been the moment when they decided to take the plunge and begin participating in oppositional politics. So, along with providing a much-needed morale boost for those already in the opposition, the defection of the Sultan's brother-in-law also brought a lot of new members over to the Young Turk camp, swelling their numbers once more moving into 1900. Damad Mahmud Pasha would set up camp in Geneva, where he would essentially take over the operations of the Osmanli Journal. Now, the old editorial board of the newspaper, which had been led by Ishak Shakuti, was honestly pretty hesitant about the Sultan's brother-in-law suddenly taking control of their paper. They were understandably afraid that Mahmud Pasha would just pull a Minzani Murad on them and defect back to the Sultan the minute that Abdulhamid offered him a good enough deal. I mean, this guy was literally married to the Sultan's sister. But Ishak Shakuti didn't have many options at this point because they were, well, broke, and Mahmud Pasha was extremely rich. But tension would quickly emerge between the old guard of the CUP, with longtime members like Ishak Shakuti, Abdullah Chevdet, and Ahmed Reza, and Mahmud Pasha and his sons. The old guard essentially wanted Mahmud Pasha to just support them financially and then get out of the way. But Mahmud Pasha and his two sons would prove themselves to have a whole lot of ideas for how the opposition should proceed. Of these new ideas, there would be two that would prove to be the most important and the most controversial. First was a concerted effort to prompt the British to intervene on behalf of the Ottoman opposition. Without getting too into the weeds with this, Damad Mahmud Pasha had long been associated with the pro-British wing of the Sultan's administration. So when the Sultan's brother-in-law defected to the Young Turks, a lot of other administrators from this pro-British wing would follow Mahmud Pasha into exile, and they would all begin to lobby British diplomats, the hope being that the British would intervene and help them to depose Abdul Hamid. Because Mahmud Pasha was such a prominent individual, he and his two sons, Sabah ad-Din and Lutfullah, essentially turned the European branches of the CUP into like a diplomatic lobbying group who spent all of their time begging the British to intervene on their behalf. Now, of course, Ahmed Reza would fiercely oppose this turn of events. Because as we have talked about, Ahmed Reza was super duper against foreign intervention. But besides Ahmed Reza and his circle, the CUP in Europe briefly began to put all of their efforts towards lobbying British diplomats. Now, this effort to prompt a British intervention was doomed to fail from the very beginning, because British public opinion had recently soured towards the Ottomans, mostly due to the Hamidian massacres. The British had kind of become the humanitarian champions of the Armenians, so they weren't really that excited about the prospect of intervening into Ottoman affairs on behalf of the Sultan's brother-in-law. So this effort to prompt a British intervention would ultimately come to naught. But while there would be no British intervention, one development that did occur as part of this diplomatic maneuvering by the pro-British wing of the Ottoman administration is that it brought another very important figure into the Young Turk camp, and that figure is Ismail Kemal. Ismail Kemal is a super important dude, and of the people we have so far introduced in this episode, the two most important figures will, in the end, not be Mahmud Pasha himself, but instead his son, Prince Sabah ad-Din, as well as Ismail Kemal. So, Ismail Kemal will one day go down as the founder of modern Albania, and Kemal will serve as the first prime minister of Albania when the Albanians declare independence amidst the chaos of the First Balkan War in 1912. But when Ismail Kemal fled the Ottoman Empire in May of 1900, he was simply another important administrator of the pro-British wing of the Sultan's administration. Ismail Kemal had first risen to prominence during the late Tanzimat era, and much like the Maronite editor of Meshvaret, Alil Ghanem, Ismail Kemal had been associated with Midhat Pasha. So he had been similarly exiled after Abdul Hamid came to power and began consolidating his rule by purging all of the followers of Midhat Pasha. So Ismail Kemal and Alil Ghanem both embodied the organic and fluid connection between the constitutional movement of 1876 surrounding Midhat Pasha and the Young Ottomans, and the later constitutional movement of the Young Turks, which would culminate in 1908. Though, while Alil Ghanem would elect to spend his exile in Paris, Ismail Kemal managed to work his way back into the Sultan's administration, and he would hold a few different important posts as a regional governor. However, once Damad Mahmud Pasha defected to the Young Turks, Abdul Hamid became predictably paranoid about all of the other pro-British administrators, like Ismail Kemal. So, Abdul Hamid appointed Ismail Kemal as the governor of Tripoli, all the way down in modern Libya, where he would be safely out of the Sultan's way. But this was so obviously a move to get Kemal out of Ottoman politics that the Albanian would take the opportunity to defect to the Young Turk cause, and he would follow Damad Mahmud Pasha over to Europe. So, Ismail Kemal future founding father of Albania, and future parliamentarian within the Ottoman Chamber of Deputies following the 1908 revolution, is now on the board. As we just said, Damad Mahmud Pasha and Ismail Kemal had initially tried to win diplomatic support from the British. But after they failed in this venture, they would instead turn their efforts towards putting together a congress to unite all of the many different factions of the Ottoman opposition. This project to build a united front consisting of all of the different forces standing in opposition to Abdul Hamid would eventually culminate in the First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition, which would be held in Paris in February of 1902. Leading up to this First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition, Damad Mahmud Pasha's two sons, Prince Sabahaddin and his brother, whose name is Lutfullah, but I'm just going to say his brother from now on, because only Sabahaddin will continue to be important after this episode, and Lutfullah is just kind of hard to say. So, Prince Sabahaddin and his brother, the two sons of Damad Mahmud Pasha and the nephews of the Sultan, would end up taking the lead in organizing this oppositional congress as their aging father gradually slid into more of a symbolic role once real planning actually began. The first move that the royal brothers would make was to get Ismail Kemal on board with their plans. And the Albanian statesman was initially hesitant, saying that the only use he could see in holding a congress was if it, number one, represented all of the component parts of the empire, and number two, if it successfully promoted a great power intervention, ideally from the British. And well, the two princes wanted Ismail Kemal on board. They were also generally pro-British, and they held a relatively liberal outlook as Ottomanists committed to pluralism. So they agreed that the Congress would aim to represent all of the different ethno-religious groups of the empire, and they agreed that the Congress would generally aim to win the support of a European great power. Ismail Kemal, Prince Sabahaddin, and his brother would be the three primary organizers of this oppositional Congress, and they would ultimately be the ones choosing who to invite. Now, this exclusive control over the guest list would make the Congress immediately controversial. Kemal and Sabahaddin obviously had to invite Ahmed Reza, Alil Ghanem, and their crew at Meshfret. But when they did invite the Meshfret crew, Ahmed Reza urged Kemal and Sabahaddin to not rely on personal invitations in this way, telling the organizers that the decisions made at the Congress would not be seen as binding if participation in the Congress was decided by just three dudes, no matter how important these three dudes happened to be. If it was invite only, those factions of the opposition who were excluded would view the Congress as illegitimate because any quote-unquote majority decision would not in fact represent the majority, as everyone would not be present to vote on motions. Ahmed Reza warned that with this illegitimate majority, Young Turk factions could simply choose to not abide by the decisions made at the Congress. But you know, Kemal and Sabahaddin were high-ranking noblemen, and they felt that they just knew better. So they maintained strict control over the guest list. This guest list would basically come to include all of the most prolific writers and publishers within the Young Turk movement in Europe, plus as many representatives as they could muster from the oppositional parties of the different ethnic groups, echoing Ismail Kemal's desire to represent all of the component parts of the empire. But in the end, really only the Albanians, the Armenians, and the Greeks would have any sort of meaningful ethnically based representation. And the two most glaring absences from this list were the Arabs and the Macedonians. Now, these are two groups that we are going to be talking a lot more about. The Macedonians we'll be catching up with very soon, and the Arabs a little bit later. But it is important to note that the Slavic revolutionary groups operating in Macedonia, like the Macedonian Revolutionary Organization, or the MRO, and Muslim Arabs who were in the opposition, did not enjoy any sort of representation at the Congress. So, right off the bat, Prince Sabahaddin and Ismail Kemal fell well short of their original plan to represent all of the component parts of the empire. And then before we move on, I also want to quickly note that not a single one of the original founders of the CUP were invited to this Congress. So Ishak Shakuti, Abdullah Chevdet, Ibrahim Timo, they did not get the invite, mostly because they were seen as like college kid activists, giving you an idea of how this Congress really only involved the super elite members of the CUP. Now, with regard to the lack of ethnic representation at the Congress, what we need to understand here is that even though there would be many Albanians, Armenians, Greeks, and Turks in attendance at the Congress, very few of them actually saw themselves as representing their ethnic groups. Most of the Congress attendees were Ottomanists who wanted to unite the empire and forge a new Ottoman identity that would carry the empire into the modern age. So this idea of representing the different ethnic groups was more than anything else a public relations stunt. Prince Sabahaddin and Ismail Kemal knew that it was important to Great Britain and France that the Congress represent all the different nationalities. So the organizers would, for example, brag to European diplomats that they had representatives from the Jewish population of the Ottoman Empire, when in fact the only Jewish attendee was a man named Albert Fuah, who was not invited because he was Jewish, but because he was a very prominent writer at Meshferet. And then a similar thing happened with Alil Ghanem, who the organizers claimed represented the Arabs because he was originally from Mount Lebanon. But of course, we know that Alil Ghanem had been living in Paris for like 20 years, and he identified much more as an Ottoman and as a Maronite Christian than he did as an Arab. So even though the organizers would seek to legitimize their Congress in the eyes of the Europeans through claiming that their constituents represented the different ethnic nationalities in the empire, in the end, the vast majority of the participants were Ottomanists. So the Congress would include Jews, Arabs, Greeks, Armenians, Maronite Catholics, Circassians, Kurds, and Turks. But at this point in 1902, the driving ideology of almost all of these groups was not ethnic nationalism, but constitutionalism, liberalism, and Ottomanism. Most of the delegates did not want to separate the Ottoman Empire into different nationalist enclaves, but instead they wanted to unite the Ottoman Empire as a pluralistic, multi-ethnic, supranational empire with a strong constitution that would ensure the rights of all Ottoman citizens, regardless of religion or ethnicity, and that would limit the autocratic rule of Sultan Abdulhamid. Now, there were a couple exceptions to this rule. The biggest exception by far were the Armenian delegates, who would be primarily drawn from the Dashnaks and a section of the Hunchaks, who, as we know, both strongly identified with revolutionary nationalism. And then the other exceptions that were slightly less pronounced were the Albanians and the Greeks, who would have delegates holding both Ottomanist and nationalist leanings. Okay, so after the invitations were sent out by Prince Sabahaddin, his brother, and Ismail Kemal, they began to look for a space in Paris where they could hold the conference. And this process would actually end up being slightly tricky, as at this point, Abdulhamid was losing his mind back in Istanbul and was pulling every lever he possibly could to shut this conference down and to bring his annoying brother-in-law and two bratty nephews back home. But Sabahaddin and Kemal proved themselves to be quite clever in this showdown with the Sultan, as they would successfully galvanize left-leaning public opinion in France to move in their favor, accusing the French authorities of being despotic stooges of the Sultan. This PR campaign ultimately worked, and the Congress was allowed to convene, although on a slightly smaller scale than had originally been planned. As the delegates began trickling into Paris in early 1902, the scheming and politicking would, of course, begin immediately. Essentially, two factions would begin to form in direct opposition to one another, even before the Congress was ever convened, as Ahmed Riza, Alil Ghanem, and the other old guard members of the CUP began issuing proclamations for what the Congress needed to cover. Simultaneously, Prince Sabah ad-Din, his brother, and Ismail Kemal were entertaining delegates at the two princes' Paris residence. During these visits, delegates began lobbying the organizers hard for their individual agendas to be prioritized. The factional split between these two groups, which will come to define the oppositional movement coming out of the Congress, would crystallize around the issue of foreign intervention. Do you want to prompt the intervention of a great power, like Great Britain, in order to depose Abdul Hamid? Or are you in principle against the meddling of the great powers in Ottoman affairs, no matter the ultimate result of this meddling? This was the heart of the split. Now, the reason that this issue of foreign intervention would come up even before the Congress convened was because of the lobbying of the Armenians on the one hand and the principled stubbornness of Ahmed Reza on the other. As we know, the Armenian revolutionary parties had been trying to prompt a great power intervention on their behalf going all the way back to the days of old Father Crimean, when Crimean had lobbied the great powers at the Congress of Berlin in hopes of forcing the Ottomans to implement actual reforms that could actually protect defenseless Armenians from arbitrary abuse. And while the efficacy of great power intervention was fiercely debated within Armenian revolutionary circles, European intervention was still seen as one of the few ways in which to actually ensure the protection of Armenian civilians. And in the years following the Hamidian massacres, the protection of Armenians from arbitrary abuse was transformed into a life or death struggle for the survival of the Armenians as a people. So, while the Young Turks were reading books and debating French sociology, or like whether Islam was progressive or not, the Armenian revolutionaries had been carrying out a full-fledged guerrilla war against Abdul Hamid's government in eastern Anatolia. As an example, in November of 1901, just a few months before the convening of the Congress, the Armenian Fedayi and member of the Dashnaks, Anjanik Ozanian, had fought a legendary battle against the Ottoman authorities at the Holy Apostles Monastery. Anjanik and his small band of guerrillas, which consisted of only around 30 to 40 irregular fighters, successfully held off literally thousands of Ottoman troops for weeks. And Anjanik would transform into a near mythical figure when he and his guerrillas successfully snuck through the Ottoman lines, when Anjanik allegedly dressed up like a Turkish officer and with this disguise managed to sneak all of his fedayi out of the monastery. After this great escape, both Armenians and the Ottoman authorities would say of the fedayi leader, "Anjanik is not a man, he is a ghost." So, while the Congress of the Ottoman opposition was ongoing, Armenian fedayi, most of whom were Dashnaks and Hunchaks, were literally out on the front lines, directly facing off against the tyranny of Abdul Hamid's regime. And one of the primary goals of Anjanik had been to use this battle to draw the attention of the foreign consuls stationed in the nearby town of Mush. So, Armenian revolutionaries were still very much trying to garner the support of the European powers. And in this effort, they were always seeking to get the great powers to actually enforce Article 61 of the Treaty of Berlin, which had promised reforms in the six Armenian provinces, and which had ensured the protection of Armenian civilians from arbitrary abuse. So, after the persistent lobbying of the Dashnak and Hunchak representatives, Prince Sabah ad-Din and Ismail Kemal agreed to include the enforcement of the Treaty of Berlin as one of the founding articles for the Congress. And well, Ahmed Reza, Alil Ghanem, Dr. Nazim, and the rest of the Meshferet crew were steadfastly opposed to foreign intervention and declared themselves as such. And to give you a flavor for this perspective held by the Meshferet faction, I'm going to read you Ahmed Reza's official statement leading up to the Congress. Quote, "I categorically reject the intervention of foreigners in the domestic affairs of our fatherland under whatever name or title. This article concerning foreign intervention was included in the first draft prepared by Ismail Kemal. Later, due to the objections of the princes, it was removed. only the fourth article has remained. I had objected to the fourth article, saying that the Constitution recognizes international treaties and that this was enough. In response, they said that our Armenian citizens would not participate unless this article, especially the resolutions of the Berlin Congress, were mentioned in the text. Since their participation was requested by everyone, I had to accept this article. So, once the Congress finally convened in February of 1902, these two factions who would come to define the oppositional movement in the coming years had already formed. And the Congress itself would be most defined by an ideological standoff between these two camps. And while there would be a lot of delegates pushing for unity and reconciliation, the Congress would be dominated by this standoff between the Armenian revolutionaries on the one hand and Ahmed Reza and his Meshvaret crew on the other. Now, knowing what is to come, it is easy to misunderstand this division and to see it as more pronounced than it maybe actually was. Both Ahmed Reza and the Armenian revolutionaries had a lot of common goals. They were similarly committed to, number one, maintaining the territorial integrity and unity of the Ottoman Empire, and number two, to reforming Ottoman society through constitutionalism, liberalism, and pluralism. For Ahmed Reza and the Meshvaret crew, the goal had always been achieving unity through Ottomanism and constitutionalism. And the Armenian revolutionaries, especially the Dashnaks, had, ever since their party was first founded 10 years earlier, committed themselves to achieving reform and autonomy within the Ottoman Empire. The Dashnaks were not separatists like the Bulgarians, the Serbians, or the Greeks. The Dashnaks were realists in the sense that they understood that Armenians represented a minority in eastern Anatolia. And so the only real option was to reform the Armenian provinces and to gain representation in Ottoman politics so that they could protect the interests of Armenians within the empire. Most of this fit in with Ahmed Reza's vision of a constitutional monarchy based around Ottomanism, in which the rights of all Ottomans, regardless of their ethnic or religious heritage, was ensured by a constitution and a liberal government. So, the divide between Ahmed Reza and the Dashnaks was much more subtle than it might first appear. And at the start of the Congress, the divisive issue really was just foreign intervention. Ahmed Reza and his circle, like the Dashnaks, were in their own way also kind of realists in the sense that they believed that the great powers would only have their own interests in mind when intervening into Ottoman affairs. And while this point from Ahmed Reza was of course true, experience had taught the Armenians that they needed guarantees of protection backed by force. So, the protection of the great powers was essential to the Armenian agenda. For the Armenians, this debate over foreign intervention was felt to be a matter of life or death. When the Congress opened on February 4, 1902, Ismail Kemal offered a statement that one of the primary goals of the Congress would be to ensure the implementation of the Treaty of Berlin, and to secure, quote, the moral support and benevolent action of the great powers in this effort. This opening statement from Ismail Kemal immediately sent the Congress into a factional tailspin, as Prince Sabahaddin followed this up by declaring that Kemal's statement represented the will of the majority of the Congress and would not be taken up for debate. So, as was to be expected, Ahmed Reza and the CUP Old Guard skewered Ismail Kemal and Prince Sabahaddin and accused them of silencing criticism and of preventing the free expression of ideas. Amidst this tussle, Prince Sabahaddin became worried that the Meshvaret faction would withdraw from the Congress and torpedo the entire project on day one. So, Prince Sabahaddin went against the will of Ismail Kemal and agreed to open up this declaration for debate later in the Congress. In response to this motion, the Armenians quickly rejected Sabahaddin's compromise, demanding that Ismail Kemal's provisions be accepted as a prerequisite of the Congress. But Sabahaddin denied this request, again because he feared that the Meshvaret faction would walk out. But in trying to prevent Ahmed Reza from leaving the Congress, Sabahaddin instead prompted the Armenians to walk out, as they refused to accept this compromise concerning foreign intervention. So, during the opening statements of the Congress, things had already devolved into two irreconcilably opposed factions. For Prince Sabahaddin, and especially for Ismail Kemal, the whole point of the Congress was thought to be the prompting of foreign intervention. And without the participation of the Armenians, the organizers knew that European diplomats would view the Congress as illegitimate because it would not represent all of the elements of the Ottoman Empire. So, on the second day of the Congress, Ismail Kemal's motion was immediately taken up for debate, and so this second day would witness fierce arguments between the two rival camps. The Meshfaret faction would launch an all-out offensive against those supporting a great power intervention, with the first speech being tactically given by Albert Fua. And this was tactical because Albert Fua was Jewish, meaning that he was both not a Turk and not a Muslim. And of course, Alil Ghanem, a Maronite Christian, would also give a fiery speech. The highly visible participation of these delegates was specifically meant to deflect the accusations that the anti-interventionist camp was representing an exclusively Muslim-Turkish agenda. And while this was a strategic and political move by the Meshfret faction, both Albert Fua and Alil Ghanem really were longtime contributors to Meshfret and were just as fervently against foreign intervention as were Turks like Ahmed Reza. So this was both a political PR move and it represented reality, because at this point, the circle surrounding Ahmed Reza represented an Ottomanist agenda, and it included many diverse elements who all pushed for greater unity within the empire and believed that the best way in which to achieve this unity was through lessening the influence of nationalism and replacing ethno-religious loyalties with loyalty to the empire as individual Ottoman citizens. So, things got heated during these debates, and apparently the delegate who was assigned the task of being the recording secretary for the Congress tried to resign on three separate occasions because it was impossible to understand what anyone was saying, with everyone sort of just yelling over each other. And at one point, Prince Sabahaddin himself took over as secretary, but he quickly grew frustrated and handed the post back and refused the resignation of the original secretary. But even though these debates were quite fierce, and the anti-interventionist camp skewered their opponents in one speech after another, the Meshfret wing was still outnumbered at the Congress, mostly because of the control that Prince Sabahaddin and Ismail Kemal had exerted over the guest list. So, at the end of day two, Ismail Kemal's motion to ensure the implementation of the Treaty of Berlin through the, quote, moral support and benevolent action of the great powers, was accepted by the, quote, unquote, majority at the Congress. In the remaining days of the Congress, Ahmed Reza and others from Meshfret would constantly ask Prince Sabahaddin to reopen the question of foreign intervention. And every time that this motion was made, Prince Sabahaddin would reject it, stating that the decision had already been made through a majority vote. And throughout the rest of the Congress, the Armenian delegates knew that they had the upper hand, so they would continue to push hard for their agenda. And essentially, what they wanted was for the Congress to commit the oppositional movement to going beyond the mere reinstatement of the 1876 Midhat Pasha Constitution. The Armenians wanted real material assurances that reforms would be carried out in eastern Anatolia to protect Armenian civilians. And ultimately, they wanted a guarantee that the Armenian provinces would be granted autonomy, so that they themselves, as Armenians, would be given the right to ensure that the reforms would actually be carried out. The Armenians had seen this sort of thing play out time and time again, running from the Tanzimat reforms through the Congress of Berlin and up to the 1895 edicts made amidst the Hamidian massacres. Armenians had seen Ottoman reformers over and over again making promises to enact reforms that would never end up actually being carried out. The Young Turks might have seen themselves as different from these reformers of the past, but for the Armenians, they were just yet more idealistic Ottoman reformers. So, for the Armenians, they needed more than a simple constitution, and more than an empty promise that reforms would be implemented at some undetermined point down the road. As the Armenians continued to push their agenda, things would reach another dramatic climax on day 4 of the Congress, when the Armenians officially stated that they wanted to go beyond the Medhat Constitution. And one Armenian delegate even declared that the Constitution was, quote, not the single tool for their national liberation, and they would, quote, never wish to see the 6 Armenian provinces of Anatolia subjected to the Ottoman Constitution. And with this statement, even Ismail Kemal got up to denounce what he saw as the intransigence of the Armenian delegates, saying, quote, I refute these comments on behalf of the majority. We are searching for suitable grounds for reforms that can benefit all parties and might be proper for you. And we do acknowledge that you are justified in your cause. But if you wish the creation of an organic law exclusively unto yourselves, I say no. No. Always no will be your answer. And we will oppose you on every occasion from this point onward. As long as you remain an element of the Ottoman state, there will be a constitution for you, just as for us. I defend your cause not in an effort to appease you. I am defending it on behalf of the interest of my state and government. I will defend it even if you do not want me to do so. I recognize you not as an independent element, but as Ottomans. You have rights as Ottomans. However, you do not have the right to bargain with us and make offers as if you were representatives of a state. The authority who granted the Constitution was not Europe, but our state. You should also bear in mind that we are not only Turks here. Greeks, Albanians, Arabs, and others are present. After this speech from Ismail Kemal, the Armenian delegates each got up one by one and walked out of the Congress. Up until this point, Ismail Kemal had been by far the biggest advocate for a foreign intervention, so his agenda and that of the Armenians had been in line for the entire Congress thus far. But the push by the Armenians to gain assurances that they would be given autonomy, and Ismail Kemal's response to this demand had brought to the foreground the real heart of the issue. The Armenians felt that they could not trust vague promises made at a Congress, and they felt that they could not count on a constitution to protect them. However, almost all of the other delegates had as their number one goal, and for some it was their only goal, the reinstatement of the Medhat Constitution. After the Armenians walked out of the Congress, the pro-interventionist camp surrounding Prince Sabahaddin and Ismail Kemal tried to reconcile with Ahmed Reza. However, at this point, the gulf between them had grown too wide. Ismail Kemal felt that foreign intervention was the only possible way to prompt change in the empire. Ahmed Reza opposed foreign intervention on principle as a matter of national dignity. So, even though they would try one last time to come together as a united front, at the end of the Congress, the Meshvaret faction, together with the old guard of the CUP, declared that they would not be joining forces with the majority at the Congress, stating, quote, we proclaim that we must work independently and wish with our hearts that the future committee to be founded by the majority will bring forth good works for our fatherland. And with that, Ahmed Reza, the editors at Meshvaret, and the rest of the old guard of the CUP left to pursue their own goals separate from the rest of the Congress delegates. After the departure of the Meshvaret faction, Prince Sabahaddin and Ismail Kemal had no choice but to try and reconcile with the Armenians. So the Dashnaks and the Congress organizers would sit down at the negotiating table one last time. And after this final meeting, the Armenians agreed that they were, quote, ready to participate in all efforts to overthrow the present regime, and that they, quote, did not oppose the establishment of a constitutional central administration that would execute special reforms for the 6 provinces. And after the Armenians made this compromise, which acknowledged the Medhat Constitution, Ismail Kemal and Prince Sabahaddin accepted the premise that special reforms would be made in the six Armenian provinces following the reinstatement of the Midhat Constitution. So, coming out of the Congress, the quote-unquote majority was at least theoretically reconciled with the Armenian revolutionaries, as both parties committed to continuing to resist Abdul Hamid, to instituting the Midhat Constitution, and to implementing special reforms in the six Armenian provinces. The first Congress of the Ottoman opposition represented a major turning point in the Young Turk movement. Not because it brought everyone together, as was its intention, but instead because it solidified the ideological divide between two directly opposed revolutionary camps. Coming out of the Congress, Ahmed Reza and the Meshfret Circle would more closely align themselves with the other old guard members of the CUP. These two groups within the CUP had long been at odds with one another, mostly due to Ahmed Reza's positivist opposition to revolutionary tactics. But at the Congress, the activist wing of the CUP found that they actually had a lot in common with Ahmed Reza and those at Meshfret, and that they were all steadfastly against any sort of foreign intervention whatsoever as a matter of national dignity. So, the Congress of the Ottoman Opposition would have the unexpected result of forming a much stronger bond between Ahmed Reza and his followers at Meshfret with this old guard activist wing of the CUP. What this meant is that even though this anti-interventionist group was technically the minority at the Congress, in reality they would come out of the Congress in a stronger position than the so-called majority. And this is because most of the delegates in this anti-interventionist camp had more experience, having been active in the opposition for many years. They also had more well-established publishing operations, and they now had a very clear ideology to guide their activities and their publications. This ideology would be anti-imperialism. As we will see, resentment towards the great powers will only grow stronger within the empire in the coming years, as Europe continues to meddle in Ottoman affairs. This growing resentment will make Ahmed Reza's anti-imperialist coalition increasingly popular within the empire, especially amongst Muslims. The pro-interventionist group, on the other hand, the quote-unquote majority, was a very disparate group, made up of many different factions with often directly conflicting agendas. You've got Armenian revolutionaries and Albanian proto-nationalists pushing for greater local autonomy, alongside disaffected Ottoman administrators pushing for a constitution that was meant to unite the empire through Ottomanism by completely removing the need for such nationalist groups. So, even though this faction technically made up the majority at the Congress, they would prove to be quite scattered and would not operate in any real coordinated way in the coming years. So, the factional split emerging out of the Congress over the issue of foreign intervention would come to define the oppositional movement in the years leading up to 1908. And just to peek ahead a little bit, both Prince Sabahaddin and Ismail Kemal will become major figures standing in opposition to the CUP following the revolution. And then, of course, people like Dr. Nazim and Ahmed Reza will be some of the most powerful leaders of the CUP directly following 1908. But the other major consequence of the Congress is something that is a bit more nebulous and can only really be identified as a major consequence with the benefit of hindsight. Or in other words, it is not clear that the delegates at the Congress would have pointed to this as a consequence at the time of the Congress. And this was a growing sense of disillusionment with Ottomanism. As we have noted many times, the vast majority of the delegates at the Congress were in some way or another committed to the overall project of Ottomanism. However, the intense disagreements at the end of the Congress over the nature of the Midhat Constitution and whether or not it would actually bring about any real changes for minority groups like the Armenians made a lot of the delegates realize that it wasn't going to be as simple as just implementing a constitution and then calling it a day. Before the Congress, there had long been this sort of utopian belief that if they could just get the 1876 constitution reinstated, then everything would suddenly be fixed. I mean, the Constitution protected the rights of religious minorities, so if everyone could just let go of their nationalist loyalties and get behind the idea that they were all now equal Ottoman citizens, then everything would be fine, right? But the Armenians had pointed out to everyone that these sorts of promises had in fact been being made for decades now, and nothing had ever actually changed for religious minorities. This perspective would come as a bit of a shock for many of the more elite and naive delegates like Prince Sabahaddin, who had lived his entire life sheltered from the terrible realities of what life was actually like for religious minorities in the empire. This loss of faith in Ottomanism will be a gradual process, and it will take many, many years to fully take hold. And the 1908 revolution will still, more than anything else, be a movement meant to usher in a new era of Ottomanism. But the seeds of future division within this utopian project of Ottomanism would be planted right here at this first Congress of the Ottoman opposition. And present at this Congress were two delegates who would, in the years following the Congress, begin to more openly argue for the need for a new ideology on which to build the revolutionary movement. And once this new ideology takes hold, it really will spell the end of Ottomanism. And that ideology is Turkism. Present at this Congress were Dr. Nazım and Yusuf Akçura, future ideologues of pan-Turkism and Turkish nationalism. Both of these men were in the minority group at the Congress arguing against foreign intervention alongside Ahmed Rıza. And 2 years after the Congress, Yusuf Akçura would publish his seminal work, Three Kinds of Policies, which would argue that both Ottomanism and pan-Islamism were impossible fantasies built upon utopian daydreams. Akçura would argue that Ottomanism was unrealistic because the different nationalities of the empire, especially the Christians, did not want to be Ottomans and preferred to separate into independent nation-states. Akçura would similarly argue that pan-Islam was also unrealistic because the Sultan did not actually rule over all Muslims, because Muslims were scattered across the globe. So, instead of Ottomanism or pan-Islamism, Akçura would argue that Turkism was the only realistic way in which to unify the Ottoman Empire. For Akçura, ethnic nationalism was an unstoppable force that must be embraced rather than resisted, meaning that the dominant group in the Ottoman Empire, ethnic Turks, needed to build their future society around Turkism. So, within the minority group surrounding Ahmed Rıza, Turkish nationalism will gradually become more and more pronounced. And in their publications, the word Ottoman will ever so slyly begin to be replaced by the word Turk. So, even though this process will take a long time to fully set in, the First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition had begun to roll the old nationalist boulder down the hill as many ethnic Turks began to lose faith in the actual attainability of Ottomanism. In the years directly following the 1902 Congress, the issue of disunity stemming from revolutionary nationalism will be brought to the fore once more in very dramatic fashion, turning the abstract arguments of the Congress into real on-the-ground conflicts. Because between the years 1903 and 1904, massive uprisings will break out amongst the Slavs and the Armenians out in Macedonia, Thrace, and eastern Anatolia. So, next week, we are headed back into the belly of the beast, back into that swirling vortex of ethno-religious conflict and revolutionary conspiracy, the place that will ultimately give birth to the Constitutional Revolution of 1908. So, join me next time as we begin the Macedonian struggle.